This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2024 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us at Socialism 2025, which will be held in Chicago next summer, July 3rd through the 6th, 2025. If you are ready to put ideas into action and get organized with others from across the country and the world, make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
All right, folks, we're going to get started. Thank you all for coming to the first session of Socialism 2024. Yeah. How many people are at your very first conference? Wow. Okay, that's more than half the room. That's really cool. Okay, well, let's get started. My name is Haley Pessin. I'm with the Tempest Collective. I use they, them pronouns. And the title of this session is 175 Years Since the Communist Manifesto, Why Marx Still Matters. So with that, let me introduce our wonderful panel. So first, we have Phil Gasper. Phil is an educator and activist based in Madison, Wisconsin, and the editor of The Communist Manifesto, a roadmap to history's most important political document, which was actually just republished. You can find copies of this in the Haymarket Books Room. Phil's also the author of Imperialism and War, classic writings by V.I. Lenin and Nikolai Bukharin, Haymarket 2017. He's a member of the Tempest Collective and on the editorial board of New Politics. Then we have Robert Cuffey. Robert is a revolutionary socialist, labor, and Pan-African organizer who has been active in the struggle for a better world for over two decades. Robert is originally from Guyana, and his focus is on Caribbean radicalism. He currently works in child welfare and is a union delegate as well as a member of abolitionist collectives Black Voices Matter and Washington Square Park Mutual Aid, while also serving as a member of the editorial board of New Politics. And finally, we have Nancy. Nancy Holmstrom, Professor Emerita from Rutgers University, is a lifelong activist and socialist scholar. Most recently, she is the author of From a Marxist Feminist Point of View, Essays on Freedom, Rationality, and Human Nature in the Historical Materialism book series. Actually, that's going to be coming out in paperback, so look out for that if you'd like to get a copy from Haymarket. And she is a reviewer and editor for New Politics. So without further ado, I'm going to let Phil take it away. Thank you.
Thanks, Haley. I'm going to give you back your computer as well. Oh.
Thank you.
Ah, hey, everybody. So, Communist Manifesto was written over 175 years ago, published in 1848. So the obvious question is, why should it still be relevant today? An article in the Guardian newspaper a few years ago said that the Communist Manifesto is currently having a moment because its ideas have a habit of popping up in times of economic and social crisis. And that article points out that huge numbers of young people are turning their backs on capitalism. Now, that sentiment has been strong since at least the 2008 financial crisis. And it's grown stronger as inequality has increased, as the far right has emerged as a serious threat, and as the climate crisis has become an existential emergency. So the manifesto is about why a revolution to get rid of capitalism is both necessary and possible, and it's about the basic principles of an alternative to capitalism. That's true, even though the word capitalism actually doesn't even appear in the Communist Manifesto. Marx and Engels refer to bourgeois society in the manifesto. Marx didn't coin the term capitalism for a few more years. What the manifesto provides us is an account of where capitalism came from, how it works, and an argument for the centrality of class for understanding the world and, more importantly, for changing it. So I'm going to go through some of those themes. Now, when I was an undergraduate, a very long time ago now, the most common criticism of Marxism was that it was outdated. Marx may have described 19th century capitalism accurately enough, but contemporary capitalism was supposed to be different. Economic crises were a thing of the past, living standards were rising for everyone, and capital and labor were partners, not enemies. Now, that was the world of the post-war boom, which lasted from the late 1940s to the mid-1970s. Since that time, the U.S. and world economies have experienced a series of sharp crises. Real wages in the U.S. are lower today than they were 50 years ago, in 1973. Inequality has increased dramatically, and we've experienced over 40 years of a one-sided class war from the top. So today, the world looks more and more like the one that Marx and Engels were describing in 1848, a point that even many opponents of Marxism acknowledge. I think it's because Marx and Engels lived at a time when modern capitalism was young that they were able to analyze the system in a way that captured its essential features and its core dynamic. The manifesto charts the way in which capitalism has shattered narrow horizons and produced technological marvels. But it also describes capitalism as a system that is increasingly running out of control. Capitalism concentrates wealth and power in the hands of a small minority. It creates huge pools of poverty. It turns life into a daily grind that prevents most people from fulfilling their potential. And it experiences frequent and enormously wasteful economic crises. It's a system that encourages greed, competition, and aggression. It degrades human relations so that they are frequently based, as the manifesto notes, on little more than naked self-interest and callous cash payment. Marx and Engels argue that capitalism is a system based on a ceaseless drive to expand, in which highly destructive economic crises are unavoidable, and which has thus become fundamentally irrational. This is what they write. Modern bourgeois society, with its relations of productions, of exchange, and of property, a society that has conjured up such gigantic means of production and of exchange, is like the sorcerer who is no longer able to control the powers of the netherworld whom he has called up by his spells. In a world threatened by pollution, global warming, and the destruction of ecosystems as the result of uncontrolled capitalist growth, I think that image has got special resonance for us today. So capitalism has raised production to the point where everybody could be provided with a decent life, but the conditions of bourgeois society are too narrow to comprise the wealth created by them. Each successive crisis can only be overcome by paving the way for more extensive and more destructive crises. Private ownership and the anarchy of marketplace competition are no longer compatible with large-scale economic production integrated at the social and global levels. But the manifesto is above all a revolutionary call to action, an explanation not only of what is wrong with society, but how it can be transformed to create an association in which the free development of each is the condition for the free development of all. Central to this strategy for change is its claim that in the modern working class, the proletariat, capitalism has produced its own gravediggers. Marx and Engels argue that capitalism has created a group of people with both the capacity and the interest to fight for the overthrow of the existing system and the emancipation of all humanity. The power of the working class is based on the fact that capitalism socializes the labor process, bringing workers together in large urban centers and in large-scale units and chains of production. At the same time, the pressures of economic life tend to push workers together to fight back against their exploitation. And because of their key economic position, workers have the collective power to bring production to a halt by going on strike. Now, of course, for long periods of time, many workers may be satisfied with their lot under capitalism, or at least willing to put up with it. But Marx and Engels argued that this state of affairs couldn't last forever. The chaotic, turbulent, unplanned development of capitalist economies eventually throws whole societies into turmoil and turns even the most modest of working class demands into a challenge to the whole system. The process is not a smooth one. The ruling class attempts to weaken the working class by exacerbating national, racial, and other differences. But such divisions can be fought and overcome as capitalism continues to intensify the class struggle. And because of their strategic economic position, workers, whether they're blue-collar or white-collar, industrial or service, have the power to become masters of the productive forces of society by abolishing their own previous mode of appropriation, and thereby also every other previous mode of appropriation. Now, in retrospect, the manifesto has an overly optimistic conception of how quickly these processes would work themselves out. But it is true that since the mid-19th century, capitalism has repeatedly shown that it cannot avoid periodic crises, and that these crises may bring the barbarism of modern warfare in their wake. At the same time, the working class has grown ever larger on a global scale, increasing its potential power to shut down the economy and to threaten the existence of the ruling class. Will there be new upsurges in struggle in the future? According to a major study issued in 2021, we're currently in a historic period of protest. The authors, and I'm quoting here from a Washington Post article about this study, looked at demonstrations between 2006 and 2020 and found that the number of protest movements around the world had more than tripled in less than 15 years. Looking closely at more than 900 protest movements or episodes across 101 countries and territories, the authors came to the conclusion that we are living through a period of history like the years around 1848, 1917, or 1968, when large numbers of people rebelled against the way things were, demanding change. But the report also notes that there are a smaller number of protests with right-wing politics focused on denying the rights of others and scapegoating racial or national minorities. An important reminder that in times of crisis, the right can grow as well as the left, and there is no inevitable path to working class victory. At the center of the manifesto's vision is the idea of working class self-emancipation. As Engels puts it, our notion from the very beginning was that the emancipation of the working class must be the act of the working class itself. Working class self-activity and self-organization is both the key to successful revolution and to the new form of society such a revolution would bring about. But unlike the early utopian socialists, Marx and Engels do not offer a detailed blueprint for the future. They say they are not interested in painting fantastic pictures of future society. Utopian dreams are unconnected with the material conditions for the emancipation of the proletariat. And it's primarily with analyzing these material conditions that Marx and Engels concern themselves. But the analysis of these conditions does allow them to formulate, in general terms, the principles on which a socialist society would be based. The first and vital step is to raise the proletariat to the position of ruling class to win the battle of democracy. Democratic working class control of society in both the economic and political realms is the defining feature of the manifesto's conception of socialism. Without real democracy, there can be no socialism. In their preface to the German edition of 1872, they point to the example of the Paris Commune of 1871, where the proletariat for the first time held political power for two whole months as a concrete example of what they had in mind. In the context of workers' democracy, the new society could advance towards its ultimate goals, the elimination of private ownership of the economy and production for the market, and the final abolition of all class divisions. Marx and Engels are clear that such dramatic economic and social changes, unlike the seizure of political power, can only come about by degrees. But through such measures as nationalization of land, banks, and large-scale industry, combined with heavy taxation of the wealthy, the new society could gradually eliminate production based on market competition and replace it with workers' control of production and democratic planning designed to meet people's needs and allow them to develop as free individuals. There's one further aspect of the manifesto's vision that's important. Capitalism is an international system. For this reason, it's impossible for a single region to break free from capitalist relations of production on its own, at least for any significant period of time. The only way in which a workers' revolution can ultimately survive is if it spreads to other countries. But precisely because the world economy is more and more characterized by universal interdependence of nations and improved means of communication that place workers of different locations in contact with one another. And remember, that those are quotes from the manifesto in 1848. And when we would say means of communication were pretty slow, but certainly today it's instantaneous. That means the prospects for international solidarity are arguably better today than at any earlier time. The manifesto's final call for workers of the world to unite is not just an abstract moral slogan, it's an essential precondition for the transformation of society. Capitalist crisis is inevitable, but socialist revolution is not. Capitalism may yet bring about the common ruin of the contending classes mentioned at the beginning of the manifesto. If we want to see socialism and not barbarism, then the most advanced and resolute section of the working class movement has to rebuild infrastructures of resistance and dissent, organizations and structures that don't disappear when movements go into a lull and that can push the struggle forward when it reemerges. With the climate crisis looming, time is not on our side. But if you accept the manifesto's analysis, that's the project that we have to commit ourselves to win the change that we need.
Thank you, Phil. Next we have Robert.
All right. Hey, everyone. How's everyone doing? All right. So I just want to say thank you to the organizers and the volunteers who put this together, as well as my co-panelists for inviting me to be here, and Haley for stepping in to moderate. So speaking about the Communist Manifesto, I think we've beat the drum. It's an old, old document. But if any of you have recently joined a socialist organization, you may have been encouraged or required to read this document, as I was in the early 2000s joining a socialist organization. And, you know, that first line is pretty chilling, that a specter is haunting Europe. But it's also very interesting that the place the specter is haunting is Europe, when you yourself are not European. I myself am from Guyana, which is the only English-speaking country in South America that was formally colonized by the British. So if we flash back to when the Communist Manifesto was published, I promised myself to do the research and try to see when the manifesto was first available in Guyana. I didn't get there, but I can tell you this much. In 1848, Guyana and the rest of the British-controlled Caribbean countries were only 10 years removed from slavery. The British had abolished the slave trade in 1807, and through their imperial grace, abolished slavery, that's a joke, in 1834, but then added a four-year apprentice period, which pretty much meant that all the enslaved Africans had to remain on the plantations nonetheless. So I say all that to say that while the Communist Manifesto is a very important document, and the practice of Marxism coming out of it is just as important as well, we do sometimes struggle to place its relevance to both historical and current activities. But one thing I would say is that what the Communist Manifesto puts forward and what Marxism argues for is that you cannot ignore the class struggle. And it's not that Marx discovered the class struggle. That's like saying physicists discovered gravity. But by putting emphasis on it, it does help us to both understand history as well as develop lessons from it through which we form the principles for our social movements, as well as help to refine the strategies and tactics we use. Because, of course, we studied what's worked before, what's not worked, and the tomes and tomes of arguments Marxists have gotten into with each other since then. So to visualize the class struggle for me then, you know, before the Communist Manifesto was written, when what eventually became British Guyana was three separate Dutch colonies on the northern coast of South America, of Essequibo, Berbice, and Demerara, the class struggle is there. In 1763, a rebellion led by enslaved Africans almost toppled the Dutch colonial system there. In 1823, in the Demerara colony, as the movement towards independence picked up steam, the rebellion there almost put the planters out of touch. And most interestingly, the 1834 rebellion, in the same year that the British had granted emancipation, specifically formed out of the fact that the working class in Guyana at that time began to develop. Because when slavery was ended and there still continued to be a need on the plantation for labor, what the British did was first they, well, these things actually happened simultaneously, but they went abroad to their other colonies to bring in indentured laborers. They brought in indentured Portuguese workers from Madeira. They brought in indentured Chinese workers. And eventually they brought in indentured workers from India. But alongside this, the former slaves had organized themselves into work gangs that would approach the plantation and say, listen, you have this work to be done. We can do it. But unlike the times of slavery where they would do it for a pittance or whatever else the slave masters decided, they were able to bargain for the wage they wanted, right? So this is the development of this working class here for the first time and the way in which the class struggle in Guyana begins to develop. And it's specifically the fact that the formerly enslaved began to create what they called a village movement where they would buy up old plantations that had shut down and build houses and create their own society, as well as bargaining for wages, that sent the planters into a frenzy, not only looking for other sources of labor, but fighting back. So in 1834, you can imagine, with this new Emancipation Proclamation and people building the village movement, bargaining for wages, they felt that they were in a position of power. And the planters felt that they were in a position of power. And this is some of what precipitated the 1834 rebellion, because some of the planters decided that with the independence of this new working class, they must fight back. And how were the formerly enslaved Africans able to build their independence? Well, for one thing, in addition to buying up the old plots of land, they would get into agriculture themselves. So some of them raised livestock. They had pigs and goats. Others planted fruit trees. And the planters decided they would come up with excuses, like saying the pigs were rooting out their crops, to kill the Africans' pigs. They would cut down the fruit trees that people would use for sustenance. And this is what started that rebellion, as Damon and other people gathered in the town square to protest against it. And as the British colonial regime started to send in their own troops. So, and I know this history from studying a lot of the works of the Guyanese revolutionary Walter Rodney, who's done a very detailed account of the history of the Guyanese working class. And I think Rodney is a good example of what it means to have a relevance for Marxism outside of Europe. Asad Haidir, who wrote a very good book on identity politics, once presented at the Historical Materialism Conference in 2018, and he made what I think is a very poignant remark, which is that Marxism has both been adopted by people of color, but more importantly, adapted as well to their particular historical situations. And if you look at Marxists like Aimé Césaire, Walter Rodney, and Dai, and other people who come from the Caribbean, you see that they're not just using this cookie-cutter approach developed in Europe and trying to filter their own history and circumstances through it, but rather to look at their society as it exists and do this deep dive, this hard work of a material analysis of what went before and what's happening now towards the point of changing the world. So the Guyanese feminist Andai, for example, whose book was recently published by Pluto Press, you know, that book is called The Point is to Change the World, which riffs on Marxist saying that, you know, the point is not to philosophize about the world, but to change it. And you see that in Walter Rodney as well with his practice of grounding, which I've talked to people about before, which develops why he was a professor at the University of West Indies in Jamaica. And at the time, after Rodney's lectures, what he would do is literally leave campus and going to working class and Rastafarian communities, and this is where the grounding comes from, and literally sit underground with them for their lack of furniture and talk to them about the thing he was talking about in his university lectures, which is black history and why black history matters and why black people and the black working class matters as well. So one of the concepts Rodney and others had come across in trying to make sense of, like, you know, where do we place what he would call these peripheral societies in the more global capitalist society is the concept of combined and uneven development, that you have the capitalist system encroaching on this part of the world where that is not the main mode of production. It's not how society is organized. And as a result, similar to what we saw in the Russian Revolution, you see a burgeoning working class coming through, as well as a burgeoning middle class that feels that they should be the rightful domestic rulers of this economy and society. And their anti-imperialism is not necessarily born out of a revolutionary anti-imperialism, but one that's just demanding self-rule. And that self-rule, as Rodney pointed out, is a necessary step forward, but is not emancipation in it of itself. So that when the manifesto says for us, in its final glorious words, workers of the world unite, if you read Walter Rodney over a century later, what he's saying, yes, workers of the world unite, but we must concretely confront the divisions that keep us from being united. In the context of Guyanese history, where there's a racial schism between the African-descended working class and the Indian-descended working class, Rodney made clear that it's not an abstract unity we have to fight for, but rather a concrete unity. And if you read Rodney's works, he goes into, like, extensive detail about the even some of the racial epithets some groups have for each other, right? So Rodney's saying that unity comes not just from saying, hey, let's all get together, but unity needs to come through the same class struggle. And this is someone who is a premier Pan-Africanist, a premier fighter for black rights, nonetheless putting an emphasis on the class struggle to say that the struggle for unity needs to happen not just in the workplace, but in our homes, in our schools, and in all the social avenues. So, you know, and one thing I think Rodney has inspired a generation of Caribbean Marxists to do is focus not just on the process of production, because as Rodney says, whereas the ruling class is supposed to be an accumulating class, the ruling class in peripheral societies accumulates very little. They're a possessing class that possess very little. So a lot of what happens with labor happens within the sphere of social reproduction, right? Not just the people who go into the factories and produce the goods, but the people who reproduce the home, reproduce the family, the cooking, the washing, who, as we know, are primarily women and non-men. And so this is why there's, if you ever go to this organization called Red Thread in Guyana, which is a feminist organization, I was very surprised about it. The biggest poster they have up in their office is one of Rodney himself. Because while Rodney never, you know, wrote any theses on the role of women in the revolution, throughout all of his works, because he does this detailed analysis, whether he's writing about how Europe underdeveloped Africa, or he's writing about the history of the Guyanese working class, or a more theoretical stuff, he's constantly pointing to the fact that this schism in the working class is getting at a division that needs to be talked about, and we cannot just push women aside in the movement. So my time is wrapping up. I'm just checking through my very carefully handwritten notes here. So this is what I wanted to say, right? So the specter of Marxism is in many ways that. You can claim Marxism as a Caribbean radical and automatically get your name added to a CIA list. in the 1950s, when the People's Progressive Party in Guyana came to power, headed by Chetty Jagan, who was a Marxist who studied in the United States with the Communist Party. And I might be getting controversial here, but I wouldn't say the Communist Party in 1950s USA was necessarily a very radical or revolutionary organization, because it was following a dictate from the Soviet Union, which had many other interests to deal with. Nonetheless, the United Kingdom and the US government were spooked enough to invade Guyana to stop this from happening in the 50s. And decades later, when Maurice Bishop and the New Jewel movement took power in Grenada, a country even smaller than Guyana with an even smaller population, you know, the ruling class put Colin Powell in charge and they organized an invasion of Grenada. Why? Because these Marxists took control. It doesn't really, you know, we can sit here and debate the authenticity of their Marxism. But the reality is the specter still remains haunting us. It is our responsibility, I would say, if Phil says that capitalism creates its own gravedigger, finally bury this thing. Thank you.
Thank you, Robert. And last but not least, we've got Nancy.
I'm going to take this thing off for your sake and my sake. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about something very abstract, but I hope that you can bear with me. I'm going to explore the concept of emotive production, of which capitalism is just an example. Marx develops the concept most fully in Capital, but it's implicit in earlier works, including the Communist Manifesto. The emotive production concept still matters because it's the essential methodological tool for understanding history, different societies, and the possibilities for social change. According to Marx, exploitation was essential to all class societies, indeed defining of class societies, both in general and each particular form. While many people think Marx's concept of exploitation applied was specific to capitalism as this extraction of surplus value, he makes clear that this is just the particular form of exploitation in capitalism. Quote, he said this in volume one, "The essential difference between the various economic forms of society, between, for example, a society based on slave labor and one based on wage labor, lies only in the mode in which this surplus labor is in each case extracted from the actual producer, the laborer," unquote. Or from volume three, quote, "The specific economic form in which unpaid surplus labor is pumped out of direct producers determines the relations of rulers and ruled," unquote. From these quotes, I infer that a particular kind of coercion and surplus extraction are connected in all class societies. Indeed, they're constitutive of the relations that define a given mode of production. Exploitation occurs when producers lack control of their means of subsistence, and hence, in order to survive, they're forced directly or indirectly to work for others who appropriate their labor's product. In slavery and in feudalism, both the force and the surplus were clear. In capitalism, less clear. Marx's specific account of how this happens in capitalism rests on the labor theory of value. But his understanding of exploitation in capitalism is broader than this. Workers, Marx says, quote, agree, i.e., are compelled by social conditions, to work for others who reap the product of their labor, unquote. with or without the labor theory of value, this is true. The motive production analysis helps us to see that exploitation also existed in post-capitalist societies. The fundamental question is always, who controls the means of production? In Soviet-style bureaucratic systems, it was the bureaucracy that controlled the means of production and subsistence, leaving the producers no choice but to work for them. And it was the bureaucracy that controlled the surplus for the needs, their needs and purposes. So this allows us to see the continuity between capitalism, feudalism, slave societies, and bureaucratic systems. But the specific differences between those modes of production are equally important. Each mode of production, as Marx understood it, has certain kinds of structures and tendencies, a certain nature, if you will. In capitalism, being a kind of competitive market system, each capitalist firm must try to maximize its own profit in order to beat the other capitalists and get a larger share of the market. So each firm is compelled to grow, to expand, to revolutionize the forces of production in order to produce more while lowering costs. Other systems, pre- and post-capitalist, do not have this built-in imperative. Indeed, slavery and feudalism were marked by crises and stasis, crises of underproduction, while capitalism sees crises of overproduction. This concept is important for several debates, starting with what changes are and are not possible within capitalism. Consider gender relations. In developed capitalist countries, women have become more independent from men and more equal, both legally and economically, than ever before. Nevertheless, they're still subject to sexual predation, as Trump has helped to highlight, and they still do the bulk of the caring labor, whether for free or for low pay. Low-paid care work fits the account of exploitation in capital, while the work women do for free does not. Feminists have often criticized Marx on this point. But since capital is intended to elucidate what makes the capitalist system tick, so to speak, unpaid work is irrelevant. And so this criticism is not to the point, in my opinion. Marxists and socialist feminists have, however, developed an enriched account of social reproduction, which tries to supplement the account in capital by showing the importance of this work, both in human terms and in capitalism, since it produces labor power. Now, the extraordinary improvements in gender relations within capitalism raises the question of whether men and women could ever be completely equal in a capitalist society. Liberals think so, and some Marxists seem to imply it by their contention that, unlike class oppression, sex and race oppression are not essential to capitalism. But while they're not logically essential, that is, we can imagine a gender and race-neutral version of capitalism, it doesn't follow that they are incidental. Indeed, as Marxist feminists, including myself, have argued, they're very likely, historically, pragmatically necessary. Consider what women have and haven't achieved. What they've achieved are their basic democratic rights, which do not threaten profits, indeed may augment them. But care work in the United States is still largely a private responsibility because supporting care work as the public good that it is would seriously cut into profits. In other countries with more social supports, the advent of global neoliberalism has meant drastic cutbacks. The nature of capitalism thus puts constraints on gender and race equality. T- Today, while individual women and minorities have moved to the top ranks of society, maybe even president, class differences among women and among blacks have actually increased. Any movements that could reduce sex and race oppression must be based on working class struggles, integrating other forms of oppression. Thus, the counterposition of class and identity politics is misleading, indeed counterproductive. Another, and perhaps probably the most important example of capitalist limits to change, is the multiple ecological crises facing the planet, which, as Al Gore's chart showed, took off with the development of capitalism. Its imperative to grow is simply incompatible with a sustainable environment. I'll return to this point in a minute. The mode of production analysis helps us understand debates about countries transitioning to capitalism. Many post-colonial thinkers have denied that Marxist analyses are applicable to countries like India because they argue India lacks key features of developed capitalism, in particular liberal political and cultural institutions. But Vivek Chhibar, using the mode of production analysis, clarifies that Marxism does not contend that capitalist development will be uniform throughout the world, but rather that certain features of capitalism are universal. Uniform versus universal. Capital's economic needs, the sine qua non being profit maximizations, are the defining ones. They are present in India, and they might be aided by the very traditional social hierarchies and oppression that post-colonialists deem to be incompatible with capitalism. The above point regarding capitalism and ecological crisis is underlined by considering the changes in the Soviet Union and China. While each country developed under Stalin and Mao, their push for development and growth was not the same as capitalism, either in scope, nowhere near the same growth, nor in cause. Unless the bureaucracy decided to develop something, it didn't happen. There was no automatic motor that drove growth as a market system does. In fact, the cause of growth was more like feudalism in that it stemmed from political rather than economic needs. As feudal lords competed with each other, so these countries competed with other global powers. Richard Smith identifies in China today a hybrid mode of production. The capitalist sector of the economy has created enormous growth. It has a 20% growth rate. But the other sector, the state-owned enterprises, which includes the commanding heights of the economy, runs on very different imperatives. Many of the state-owned enterprises are justly called dinosaurs because they would have gone extinct in a fully capitalist economy. But the government cannot afford to let millions of people be unemployed, so they create things like ghost cities, which you may have read about. Though totally irrational from a capitalist point of view, as Western economists never tire of pointing out, they make sense in the bureaucratic mode of production. This combination of market-driven growth in the largest economy in the world and the lack of even minimal political democratic checks typical of capitalism is causing what Smith has called an ecological apocalypse. Environmentalists who advocate a simpler, no-growth economy are 100% correct. But unless they also recognize that this is impossible within capitalism, there are another variety of climate change deniers. Finally, the mode of production analysis also gives us the key conditions for socialism. As Marx conceived it, this is a society where the means of production are under collective democratic control. So the conditions for exploitation do not exist. The producers control the product of their labor, and they get it all back collectively. This is expressed in the famous quote from Capital, Volume 3, quote, "The producers rationally regulate their interchange with nature, bring it under their common control, with the least expenditure of energy and under conditions most favorable to and worthy of their human nature. Beyond that is a true realm of freedom." He says, quote, "The shortening of the workday is its basic prerequisite," unquote. Today, it's ever more clear that, in Rosa Luxemburg's words, humanity's choice is between socialism and barbarism. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you liked this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.